Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters scheduled for argument this morning. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 100451, Natural Gas Pipeline Company of America versus William Justice and others from Lamar County and the 6th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 100491, Parts Bluff Game Ranch, Inc. versus the State of Texas and the Texas Water Development Board from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. And 100513, Matthew Wasserman, MD versus Christina Bergeron Google from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these matters, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. The arguments are being recorded, and there will be a link to them posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. Court is ready to hear argument in the first matter, 100451, Natural Gas Pipeline Company of America versus William Justice.
And please, the court, Mr. Busby will give an argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The pipeline compressor stations that petitioner NGPL operates are heavily regulated by the government. Here, the record of state testing and on-site monitoring shows that Station 802 generally complied with its state and federal permits and that NGPL promptly addressed issues raised by regulators. It also consistently investigated when it received complaints from the station's neighbors. Now, 6 years after the station began operations, several neighbors filed this permanent nuisance suit and obtained a $2 million judgment. This court should reverse and render judgment for NGPL for two reasons. First, the two-year statute of limitations bars the plaintiff's permanent nuisance suit. And second, there's legally insufficient evidence of damages because the plaintiffs offered only conclusory opinions of damages, of lost property value damages that were unsupported by any factual basis.
When does the statute begin to run here?
Our position is that the conclusive evidence shows that the statute began to run sometime prior to August 1996, which is 2 years before suit was filed. And that's based on the plaintiff's own evidence in this case. And what we have to show, because limitations is our burden, is that was there conclusive evidence that the station first caused unreasonable discomfort or annoyance prior to August of 1996? And here's what the record shows, that it was no later than 1994 for noise and no later than 1995 for odor.
But how's that measured?
Well, it's measured, the standard in the charges, did it cause unreasonable discomfort or annoyance to persons of ordinary sensibilities? And so the plaintiffs, we look to the plaintiff's testimony about what they were experiencing out there, which is uncontroverted in the record. In 1993, Mr. Bubba Justice said that noise from the station was keeping him awake. In April 1994, he and his wife hired a lawyer to write NGPL saying the noise was causing them total frustration and torment. And that they had a claim for the loss in value of their land at that time in April 1994.
It says that in the lawyer's letter?
Yes, sir. And that's Defense Exhibit 21. And in May 1994, Joe Donald and Judy Mashburn also hired a lawyer to write to my client that they're writing that their lives had been disrupted by the noise and it had affected their peaceful use of their homes and property. That's Defense Exhibits 23 and 25. With respect to odor, there were odor reports in 94 through early 96, and the one that I'll mention to the court is the January 1995 complaint from Mr. Bubba Justice. This was some notes taken of a complaint that was called in, I believe. It's Defense Exhibits 19 and 32, saying that Mr. Justice and his wife could hardly breathe because of the fumes from the plant and that the smell was so bad that it was making them sick, and that was in January of 95.
But if those odors were, they came and they went, why weren't they temporary odors from 1994 to 1998 or so, and then this became a permanent nuisance, if you will, Can they change character? I guess that's my legal. Can they change character that way? Yeah, it bothers us, but it's not that bad.
I think they could change character, but there was no testimony to the effect that Your Honor mentioned that it's not that bad. This is not like a case that was cited by the plaintiffs in the brief, a case from the Fifth Circuit called Sunray Oil versus Sharp, where the plaintiff was saying, well, there's some noise or vibration from a compressor station, and it was considerable in 1949, but it was not substantial or highly offensive until 1951, which was within the two-year limitations period. There's no testimony from anybody that it was only temporary or it was not substantial or it was not offensive until we got within 2 years of the limitations period.
I mean, can I ask you, please, but wasn't there evidence that the noise and the nuisance, if you will, changed substantially during 1997 and 98, going from perhaps disagreeable or undesirable to unbearable? And if it was, isn't that at least some evidence supporting the jury's findings?
Well, there was no evidence that they said it was only disagreeable or undesirable before and it's unbearable after. There's no testimony to that effect in the record. I know that's what the plaintiffs characterize it as in their brief, but if you read the citations there, the plaintiffs never say that.
But
there is evidence that it got worse, to your
worse.
Point.
Those,
yes,
those
Your Honor.
Words were.
Yes, there is evidence that it got worse. But and what this court has said is the question. In Schneider, this court said the question is, when does the substantial interference first occur? Mm-hmm. It can get, the question is, even if the full extent of the damages have not occurred, what you have to find out, because this is a permanent nuisance claim, is when did it first cause unreasonable discomfort or annoyance? And even if the full extent of the damages has not yet occurred, that will cause the claim to accrue. And this court said the same thing in Exxon versus Emerald Oil recently, that limitations runs when facts exist that authorize the plaintiff to seek a judicial remedy, even if you don't know the full extent of the injury yet. You can't sit back and wait to see if things get worse. You have there's a policy of diligence behind the statute of limitations that requires the plaintiffs to sue.
Was sending the letter seeking a judicial remedy?
Well, they were representing in the letter that they had a judicial remedy at that time. And I think that's right on point with Exxon versus Emerald Oil, because that's the question. Are you authorized to seek a judicial remedy? Clearly, they thought they were because they had their lawyers write us and said, we have a claim.
And that's Exhibit 21.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's say you're right on limitations. Where does that leave a landowner under these kind of conditions?
Well, Your Honor, I think the landowner, if they feel like they have a claim, they need to go ahead and file suit.
I mean, they delayed, it's unclear whether it was substantial or insubstantial or whatever, and they end up filing suit to protect their interests, and they're out on limitations. Is that just it for them?
Well, in this case, their lawyer, they had already hired lawyers to sue. I understand. And, I think if they feel like if they have complaints of total frustration and torment and that there are things that are making them sick, then yes, the law requires them to be diligent and file suit. If the other case were the rule and we were in this court were to say, okay, so you complained about all these things, but you said it's getting worse, and that's enough to reset the limitations period.
It's not like a car wreck where you have an incident and you have your 2 years to run. This is a continuing situation.
Yes.
And so, but it's your position that nonetheless, they're out of limitations, they have no remedy.
Because they sued for a permanent nuisance, that's right.
And they will never have a remedy. What if today the emissions became so toxic that people couldn't live there? Are you saying that wouldn't be a substantial change either, that from this point forward there can be no nuisance claim against your client?
No, Your Honor. What Schneider says and what this court has said is you need a substantial change in the nature of the nuisance. In effect, that you would have a different injury. And the examples that have been given in the cases are if there are objective physical changes, say another pipeline was run into the station, or there are extraordinary new forces like a flood in some of the cases that have given rise to new damages that you couldn't anticipate at the time you brought the prior suit. Of course, it's not fair to say that you can't sue for those things. But there's no evidence that there were any sort of objective physical changes to the plant or extraordinary new forces at work here. So, yes, we absolutely agree that if you couldn't anticipate those damages at the time that the original suit should have been filed, then you should be able to bring another claim. But there's no evidence of that here.
The language that was used in Schneider is, conversely, once the conditions begin to recur more often, the nuisance should normally be treated as permanent because it is injury to the property in general that has occurred. Is it your position that in 1994, when they began complaining about the odor, and then in 95, and then in 96, and in January, and then in March of 96, that that sequence of events fits within that language, the conditions begin to recur more often?
Yes, Your Honor, and the plaintiffs have never contended that it was only a temporary nuisance at the time in 94 and 95 and 96. There's no evidence that those conditions would meet the Schneider definition of a temporary nuisance, where it was so sporadic that you couldn't predict when it would come back. I mean, all the evidence has been that this, whenever the wind blows their way, this is something that they smell or hear.
So let's assume that they should have sued back then for that permanent nuisance. In 1998, when things changed, the odor became even more substantial, and they were cited and they corrected the problem. Was that a temporary nuisance? Can they recover for that if you don't recover for the rest?
I think they could have brought a temporary nuisance claim, and in fact, I believe their petition did include a temporary nuisance claim, but they chose not to submit that to the jury. And so, yes, I think, you know, that would have been some evidence to support a temporary nuisance claim when the state came in and cited NGPL saying, you know, this is a Category 5 odor. But then the state came back and did eight times and did testing over subsequent years and said that the odor had been resolved. So our position is that's a temporary nuisance claim. And if you wanted to submit that, you had pled it and you were entitled to submit that to the jury.
You shift gears and talk about the evidentiary point.
Certainly. With respect to the damages, this is the other reason that the court should reverse and render for us, because the only evidence of damages that the plaintiffs offered to their property values was their own conclusory opinions, and that evidence is legally insufficient to support the award of $1.2 million. Now, the property owner rule, which this court has visited recently, obviously makes property owners presumptively qualified to opine on the value of their property, but they also must provide a factual basis to support their opinion of damages. This court and many others have held that an opinion can't be speculative or conclusory, and it must be supported by relevant facts. And we've collected the cases at page 22 of our merits brief. The owners here are simply saying that they're familiar with the market value of the property, and that doesn't meet the factual basis requirement. Really, you've got two separate inquiries here. One is, why would this witness know what the property is worth? Are they qualified to get on the stand and talk about that? The other question is, how did the witness arrive at the number that they gave for the value of the property, and is there sufficient evidence to support that number? Now, familiarity with property values is only going to answer the first question, are they qualified to testify? It establishes, but it doesn't provide a factual basis of how did you get to this number that you threw out to the court. And if that weren't the rule, if all you had to do is say, I'm familiar with the value of the property, what you would have, I mean, somebody could get on the stand and say, I think my property was worth $1 billion and it's worth zero. And if that's all the evidence, now it's worth zero and I own the property and I'm familiar with it.
What would you require of property owners?
Well, at one example, I think you have to provide some factual, I'm not going to say in every case it has to be this, but you have to provide some facts that show how you got to the number. And it's easy to do in a prior case between these very parties. That's discussed on page 16 of our reply brief most lengthily. The Court of Appeals held that Mr. Justice had given damage testimony that did have a foundation, and some of the things that he mentioned were an appraisal of the property for an easement and the selling prices of two nearby pieces of property. Those are some examples of the kinds of things you can do, but this is not,
difficult. Do they need to present calculations of why market value goes up or down and why it may go up or down? I mean, what level of sophistication or specificity would you require of property owners?
Well, I don't think the court has to get into the details of saying what you have to have. I mean, because we didn't have anything here. We just had a number. And so you need some reason to believe that the number you're throwing out there has some tethering to the reality outside the head of the person who
is. Do you think it ought to be whatever it is, it ought to be looser and more generous for property owners as opposed to other witnesses testifying as to property value?
I don't think so necessarily, because I think the property owner rule answers a different question. Are they qualified to get up on the stand and testify as a matter of the admissibility of their testimony? I think that the factual sufficiency, the legal and factual sufficiency standard should be the same for a lay witness as it would be for an expert witness. I mean, this court has said you can't speculate and you have to have some relevant facts to support your testimony. And I think the rule should be the same in the lay witness context, whether it's a property owner or someone else. Yes, they can get on the stand, but.
You sort of characterize the testimony as, well, you know, I'm familiar with market value and here's what I think it is. But does the record show that some of the witnesses had a bit more factual kind of basis for their numbers?
Here's what the record shows. I don't believe that it shows any basis for the numbers that says, here's how I got to this number. I think that's what's required. Something that would say, you know, I'm not just pulling this out of the air, or here's how I got to this number. The witness's testimony falls really into two categories. One is that they're generally familiar with property values in the area from their work or from selling other property over the years. Mr. Joe Donald Mashburn said he was a loan officer, so he was generally familiar with this because of his work. Some of the other plaintiffs had sold property. Now that qualifies them as witnesses, but it doesn't provide any basis for the opinion that the nuisance has diminished the value of their property by a particular amount. I mean, there was no discussion of how they got to the number or why the other pieces of property were comparable or anything like that they had experience with. Now there were other plaintiffs made the conclusory assertion in their damages testimony that the numbers they were giving were based on fair market value, and they used those magic words, market value, fair market value, something like that. But there was no support for that, and this court said in Porras that magic words are not enough. You need to show some reason why, how you got to that number.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Busby.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court? Mr. Rogers will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, counsel. Thank you. In addressing the issue that Mr. Busby brought up about the statute of limitations and the accruing of the cause of action, and in reference in the brief, there is some argument that perhaps we're trying to change the Schneider case. In fact, I think the Schneider case was the blueprint that this case should be analyzed by, because Schneider stands for the proposition it is when the nuisance becomes a substantial interference. Well, substantial by its very nature has some vagary within that. For instance, if you look at the city of Abilene versus Downs, there was a sewage plant that was installed. People could smell the odor of a sewage. But yet, while it might be annoying to them, while it may be, if you might ask them, they might say it was substantial. But as far as jurisprudence, the law said, well, no, not until there's substantial interference can you bring this action.
What impact, if any, does the December 1994 letter have?
Well, I think the letter certainly sets out that there were complaints, but it does not establish that there was substantial interference, because the rest of the testimony shows that NGPL said, whatever you're smelling is faint, it was passing, it was a transitory, we've taken steps to correct that. And as Mr. Busby said in his very first comment to you, we're a real well-regulated industry. We're tested all the time by the state, and we're in compliance. So whatever you smelled or whatever you heard, we have addressed, it is passed on. But what happened different is, and this is where the evidence is very important, all of the plaintiffs testified that in 97 or 98, something changed dramatically. It became much worse.
But you began to complain in 1994 and at least through 1996. Yes. And the language in Snyder says, if a nuisance occurs several times in the years leading up to a trial and is likely to continue, then you have enough evidence of frequency and duration. Why didn't those documented complaints beginning in 1994 establish that you in fact had a permanent nuisance at that time? Well, I'm not understanding how you get around that.
In fact, the cases say when you have a right to seek judicial relief, you must show a substantial interference. By definition, that means interference alone is not enough. That's exactly what was said in the city of Abilene versus Downs. The very same argument that Mr. Busby started his argument is what people would be faced with. We're regulated, we're tested, we're within compliance, we're always okay. But our evidence is in 97, 98, these people said it got unbearable. It became much worse. Not just them, but third parties said that as well.
But in 1994, Joe Donald and Judy Mashburn wrote, "Their lives have been disrupted, and the noise has affected their peaceful use of their homes and property." And it seems from the record that it continued through at least 1998.
All of the testimony was in 97 or 98, the situation became much worse.
But in 1995, Bubba Justice complained that he and his wife could hardly breathe because of the fumes from the plant. So, Mike, again, my question is, why wasn't that enough at the time? Did, even though they had assurances from NGPL that everything was fine, certainly they knew it wasn't.
Well, if you look at the city of Abilene versus Downs, where the landowner is living next to the sewage plant and he smells sewage, but yet the court says, and I don't think anybody could say smelling sewage wouldn't be, if you were the landowner, to you it's annoying and everything, but does it rise the level to which you can have judicial intervention and seek a nuisance claim? You have to show substantial interference. So what we had in this case is a condition that much worsened in 97, 98 to a point that a rural mail carrier went to his employer and said, I want to change jobs. I can't go out there.
But the fact that it got worse in 97, 98 doesn't mean it wasn't substantial before
that.
No,
that's a fact issue for the jury, and that's what the jury found, is that it became substantial in June of 1998. So what they heard was they heard the testimony about the letters. They heard the testimony about the prior complaints. They heard the testimony of the worsening condition. They also heard the testimony of the defendants that there was nothing substantial in 92 to 97 at all. But then they also found the citation from the state of Texas in 98, which is for the first time the state of Texas found substantial interference and cited NGPL for that. I think under the standard of review of legal insufficiency, and the jury can believe or disbelieve various parts of the testimony, that would be enough to say there is some evidence to support this verdict, and you're to ignore anything to the contrary on that. Now, NGPL argues, well, the state of Texas cited them in 1998, then they had 8 tests thereafter, and there was no citation. But the record in the case clearly shows those 8 subsequent testing was not really testing at all. They were self-reporting by NGPL themselves. In fact, it was found that inspectors were writing reports in Tyler and never coming up to the facility where supposedly the noise had been corrected. And so a jury would be able to piece together and believe various parts of what, and that's why the jury issue was submitted. When did it become substantial? Because there was evidence both ways.
In 1994, could you evaluate, though, the reasonable impact of having that plant there? Do you believe that they could have evaluated that these noises would continue, these odors would continue?
Well, you'd have no
just
way
having this plant there, but because I think Snyder talks about the point in time when you can reasonably evaluate the future impact.
When does it become substantial is what it all comes down to. That is the question. What one person may think is substantial to them, the courts may say is not substantial. Just like the people living next to the sewage plant in Abilene case, they may have thought it was substantial to them, but that still does not give them a right to seek judicial relief. Now, here we have a situation where the state of Texas agreed. When it's like these people came up with this, it was as if maybe they were just making this up, that it got a lot worse in 97 and 98. And lo and behold, that's exactly when the citation
you're
from the state of Texas.
You're saying, in effect, there could never be a summary judgment, a successful motion for summary judgment in a case like this.
I think each case is going to stand on its facts, its unique facts of the circumstances. There certainly could be situations where it's absolutely clear you have substantial interference and there could be summary judgment evidence, but in a situation where, for instance, the landowner is having to try to bring this case, he's not in control of the premises, he's not in control of facilities out there. The people that are, and supposedly the regulators for the state, are saying everything's fine. Whatever you smelled was faint and passing and transitory, and we're putting up sound boards and whatever, so you just wait and you're okay. Well, then as a landowner, you say something. Well, I don't know what happened at that facility, but in 97, 98, it got tremendously worse, and lo and behold, even the state of Texas found substantial interference.
But in arguing that what's substantial to one person may not be substantial to another, what you are arguing, even if there could be a possible summary judgment, is that for one landowner, there might be a permanent nuisance, and for the guy next door, might not be.
Well, but I don't think it's substantial to that party. I think it's substantial overall. I don't think you could say, hey, it's substantial to Mr. Smith, but it's not substantial to Mr. Jones.
But that was your argument.
Well, but no, what I said is it raises a fact question on when it became substantial.
So everything goes to trial.
Well, I think every case could be different. You could have a situation where, let's say in 94, when the people wrote the letter or complained, and let's say the state of Texas had cited NGPL and found that they were not in compliance, but yet nobody did anything, or they didn't file anything. Or the defendants said, yes, we are putting out a certain level of noise and odor, and we're never going to be able to change that.
But if you have a single landowner who says, in my personal subjective view, things got subjectively worse, that would be sufficient to survive summary judgment.
Might be sufficient to survive summary judgment, but still you're going to have to secure a jury finding, and then if you were to somehow prevail, survive a factual sufficiency review at the Court of Appeals level.
Well, you are arguing is that if Jones brings that suit and loses, Smith can bring the same suit and say, well, Jones is just not as sensitive to this as I am.
No, I don't know about that. I'm not sure. But
I thought you said what was substantial to one person is substantial.
No, what I don't mean as far as substantial as far as the rule. What I'm saying is you may think it's substantial to you. It's just like the people that live next to the sewage plant in the city of Abilene. If you smell sewage, how can somebody else tell you, well, that's not really that bad? To you, it may be. But that does not necessarily authorize you to be able to go and prevail on a nuisance claim when they're able to say, that's transitory, we're going to fix it, it's going to get better and everything. You may not be satisfied with that argument, but do you have the right, can you go in and prevail on a nuisance claim when you have absolutely no proof, when, like in their testimony, they said these odors were faint. This noise, don't worry, it's going to go away. How can you, even though it might be, in your mind, you know, not anything minor, but yet you're faced with the inability to prove or do anything, but then the condition does substantially worsen to where even the state of Texas acknowledges that it was a Category 5
I still
violation.
Don't understand why that doesn't mean a different result in every suit.
Well, I don't think it means a different result. I think it means you submit the issue to the jury.
Right, but
and
a jury
that's a
in one case could resolve it one way, and a jury in another case with the neighbor, the adjacent neighbor, could resolve it the other way.
And I think that happens in litigation all across the spectrum, that sometimes happens. But I think in this situation, is the jury's finding of June 12, 1998, is there some evidence in the record to support that, ignoring that to the contrary? Yes, there is. There's
you
a category.
About the postal worker who had been in that route for 25 years and there's a substantial change. Were there other third parties
all of the plaintiffs testified. There were no other third parties that testified, and then we had the citation from the state. But interestingly, in the defendant's witnesses that they put on, appraiser, an expert that went out there, not a single one of them testified there was not odor and noise of a substantial interference type. They presented no evidence that there was not of that sort of situation.
Excuse me, I have a question. Why didn't you submit an issue on the temporary nuisance to the jury? Why didn't you do that?
Well, in our opinion, we believe that it became a substantial interference in 97 and 98 when all of the people testified that it became a substantial interference, and that's when it became unbearable, which was in line with the state of Texas finding of the substantial interference in 98. So our position was it became a substantial interference at that time and continued on.
But why didn't you just plead that alternatively?
Well, if you claimed that it was a series of temporary, I am sure NGPL would have come in and said, oh, we've been doing this just like the same for years. We've been putting out noise and the odor, and it's been the same for all these years. In fact, that is what they somewhat said on cross-examination. So if you got into a temporary nuisance argument with them, they would say, oh, no, we've been doing this, forever, or since we put the plant in. And then also, under the very definition of permanent nuisance, by the time we went to trial, and this case was an old case, by the time it went to trial, we had filed suit originally. We did plead the alternative theories, but by the time you went to trial, the testimony from all the people was, not only was it still the bad, like it got in 97, 98, it continued on all the way up to the trial some 8, 9, 10 years later. So their own, the own continuation of it for a decade would have showed that it was permanent as opposed to temporary at that point.
Mr. Busby says the evidence that your clients gave the court on damages is conclusory and legally insufficient, and you say what?
I say the property owner rule has long been in Texas, and in these particular folks that testified, we had a gentleman that was on the state water planning committee, director of a bank, director of electric cooperative, loan officer at a bank, people had bought and sold property, people that their families had lived in this area for over 150 years.
And Mr. Busby said, fine, that may go to their qualifications, but not to the basis, to the underlying foundation of their number.
If you try to put something else on the property owner rule to say, hey, you've got to show some sort of calculation, aren't you saying they got to do it like appraisers and show something? I think the whole basis and the case law says the property owner rule is to be construed liberally. Do these people have a basis for knowing the value of their property? They all testified to that basis. They said they were knowledgeable about market value. Some of them even had more experience than the average person would be. So if the property owner rule is going to have any viability, then that is the type of testimony you would be.
Now, property owners give conclusory testimony on value?
Well, I don't think it was conclusory. I think it's conclusory for them to argue that it is conclusory because they testify. We've lived out in this property. Here's what we do with it. Here's what we're faced with, the noise, the smell, the odor. I'm aware of market value. I would have to tell anybody who was going to purchase my property about all of this and aware of other transactions. I don't know how that's conclusory. I don't think that is conclusory. They didn't just pull it out of the air. They gave their basis. Now, they may disagree with their opinion, but I think the case law says that goes to the weight to be submitted to the jury for cross-examination or whatever to be given. But to try to put anything else on the property owner rule is going to add something that never has existed. In fact, it would kill the rule because how could a property owner then ever give an opinion if you're going to say, well, now show me your calculations, show me your comparables, show me exactly the methodology you used. Did you use the income approach or the capitalization approach or whatever? That would defeat the whole property owner rule, which has been a basic part of Texas law for years. So
The Court of Appeals quotes the Ms. Christine Mashburn as saying that their home in 3 acres would be worth maybe $100,000 if it didn't have the pump station, but she didn't think it'd be worth anything with the pump station. We might get $10,000 or $20,000. So would that support a finding of zero value for that property? It's some evidence, as you say it is.
It would be some evidence, but
the jury said that property is worth zero, it seems like if we take what you're saying, and that's the rule, then there would be legal and factual sufficiency to support that.
I think there'd be a factual sufficiency argument on that.
But there certainly would be legally sufficient evidence for finding of zero, even though the property's still out there. Home and property they're living in.
I think it'd go to the weight to be given that testimony by a fact finder.
Would be legally sufficient under your position.
Yes.
And that's the qualm I have, is that your approach seems to fuse and blend qualification with sufficiency if it's a property owner doing the testifying.
Well, but I think the whole basis of the property owner rule is to say, first off, you don't ever get to that point unless you've got some viable cause of action that something has happened and damaged your property. I mean, you can't just come in and say, I want X number of dollars because there hadn't been anything happen. But the property owner is able to come in and say, this is my property. This is what I've always done with it. It's been well maintained. I'm knowledgeable about property area. I'm having to live next to a pump station where there is constant odor and noise and vibration. And in my opinion, it's decreased the value of my property.
So if a landowner says, I've lived here for 20 years and I know what my neighbors have sold their property for, now there's this odor and this noise, and I think my property is worth X now, would that be legally sufficient?
That is some evidence.
Whether or not it's legally sufficient evidence.
I think it's legally sufficient. Whether or not it's persuasive might be something else, but it would be legally sufficient
totally
evidence.
It's totally insulated, though, from appellate scrutiny altogether.
No, it wouldn't be totally insulated. I think you got to look at the circumstances. You got to look at what the complaint is. You got to look at what is the damage that's been suffered. I mean, is this some minor trifling thing, or is there a valid basis for what is being argued here? These people gave very descriptive testimony about the impact on their property and so forth. So I don't think this is just, just pull something out of the air. These people gave pages and pages of the impact and all, and I think that all goes into not just their qualifications to give that opinion, but the basis of that opinion.
Mr. Rogers, can you, going back to the permanent nuisance, what is a Category 5 citation?
That means,
what's the high and what's the low and what is?
Oh, five is the highest. And under the state guidelines, and this shows up in the record, five is when you have substantial interference. Anything less than five is not a substantial interference under the state of Texas' own regulatory guidelines. So the state of Texas themselves in 1998 found for the first time a substantial interference. And to go back to the argument that that was previously made, how are landowners, farmers, ranchers, school teachers, without the sophistication and the capability of the state of Texas, if the state of Texas didn't find a substantial interference until 1998, how could somebody out there have a judicially recognized claim they could go into court and prevail when even the state of Texas didn't find the substantial interference until 1998? But the Category 5 is the worst category. There's five categories, five being the worst, and in its own description of what a Category 5 is, there is the words substantial interference.
Is difficulty breathing substantial interference?
Well, that's where it might get. And what is difficulty in breathing? You know, and that's there's lots of vagaries here, which is exactly why substantial interference was submitted to the jury. All of these things we talked about, the letters, the Category 5, the previous complaints, all of that came in front of the jury. I think the analysis is when the jury said June of 1998, there was evidence to support that. The postman, the plaintiffs, the state of Texas itself. There was evidence to support their finding. Now, you have to ignore the evidence to the contrary if there was evidence to support that finding under legal sufficiency review, and there certainly was in this record. This was a hotly contested case. There were facts. But that was a jury issue, and that is what the jury found, and it did have support in the evidence. In fact, the date the jury found is when the state of Texas gave the citation. Now, they may argue, well, that citation was dated June 12th. They must have done the study a few days before. I think that's a difference without any distinction there. The jury found substantial interference based on evidence, and they only needed some evidence to survive a legal insufficiency, and that occurred in this case.
Is there any evidence that the state was out there any other time other than that one time?
We asked. What we found out is they didn't go back out there.
I mean, neither before. Is there any
evidence?
Well,
there is some evidence they went before.
Before?
They had gone before.
So the only evidence is before.
And then afterward, they did these, what they call office reviews. That's where the company fills out these reports, sends it into them. The inspector sits in his office.
So you're saying there's no evidence the state was out there afterwards?
There is only one incident that we know of where anybody came out again. There was an incident where they described they come out in a pickup and drove around one afternoon. But that's
was that the state?
That was somebody hired by the state, is my understanding. But that was the only incident which we're aware of.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you.
Mr. Busby, Mr. Rogers says the Category 5 violation in 98 is the state of Texas declaring that this is a substantial interference. And what do you say?
Well, our response is, Your Honor, you can't have it both ways. The state is declaring that it's a substantial interference at that point, but then the state also came out, and to Justice Johnson's point, I disagree with the characterization of the record. And if you look at pages 6 and 7 of our brief, there were 8 investigations made after the citation by the Commission's Tyler Regional Office staff, including odor surveys, where they actually came out to the property, and all the citations are in our brief at pages 6 and 7, during which no further nuisance conditions have been documented. State investigators returned again to conduct 41.5 hours of continuous air monitoring near the station in November 2002, and that the monitored compounds did not exceed air quality standards and were below the levels that would be expected to cause adverse health effects or odors. So you can't come in and say, oh, well, the state cited you for a substantial interference, but then ignore that the state later concluded that that was resolved. You've got to take both parts. And so if the state says it's resolved, then all that is evidence of a temporary nuisance.
Why is the jury required to accept both?
Well, the jury is, as far as the state piece, because, I mean, that's what the state concluded. The state said there was a violation and that it was later resolved. Now, the jury certainly can consider the plaintiff's testimony that things got worse, but as I described earlier, that's not the standard. The question is, was it substantial? Was there evidence that it first became substantial before 2 years before the suit was filed.
To whom? The point that was made earlier is, yes, the plaintiffs may think difficulty breathing and that sort of thing. You and I may think, well, that's it's not so bad. But you do have evidence from this mail carrier who had been there 25 years and who had, he said sometime in 1997 and 98, it got so bad that I didn't want to deliver mail there anymore.
That's true. And Justice Heck's question picked up on this earlier, and the answer is that it has to be an unreasonable discomfort or annoyance to persons of ordinary sensibilities. That's what the charge says. So it's an objective standard. It's not a subjective standard. And as to the postman, if you look at page 16 of our merits brief, we summarize the testimony there. He says that the fumes burned his nose and throat after the station was built and got worse in the late 1990s. I'd also like to address City of Abilene versus Downs, which was brought up. That was a case where the plant in that case had not reached full capacity at the time that the initial complaints were made. It later, the capacity increased. And so the court said, well, the capacity of the plant is increasing, so you can have the accrual at the time the capacity increased later. There was no evidence of any of that type of change here, any kind of substantial change in terms of the physical things that were going on at the plant. Also, there was a discovery rule issue submitted in City of Abilene versus Downs, and this court has subsequently clarified that the discovery rule is generally not applicable in nuisance cases, and it was not submitted here.
Mr. Busby, you in your brief argue that we should discount their statements that the odor got worse because they had no objective evidence to substantiate those statements. What does objective evidence look like from your perspective if we're not to place much weight on the testimony of the people actually out there?
Well, I think there are a number of ways you could do. They came out and did the air monitoring in this case, for example, the state did and sent people out to do that. So there are a number of ways you could measure it objectively, but I don't think the court needs to hold that in this case in order to say that the statute of limitations applies because of the plaintiff's prior complaints. As far as the damages, I'd just like to point out that the Court of Appeals conceded at page 20 of its opinion that basically if we're right and the standard is that you have to have some factual basis for the number, that there's no evidence of that. What they said is the record is silent. They said the defendants didn't bring out any testimony, and neither did the plaintiffs, of course. So the record is silent regarding the facts supporting the plaintiffs' opinions, including how they determined their claimed losses of property value. So if this court holds that that is the standard, as we submit it should based on all the cases we've cited in the brief, even the Court of Appeals is saying they don't have any evidence of that. And so we would ask the court to reverse and render judgment on either of those bases.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.